This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's start with a conversation with Jason Turner, the head of multi-asset strategies for Wintrust Wealth Management. That's at wintrustwealth.com. Jason returns to the show. It's nice to have you here, Jason. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me back, John.
I want to talk a little bit about jobless claims. We're at a new pandemic low, right?
That's right. Lowest level we've seen since the beginning of March last year.
And there's a lot of conversation about so many of the states are now not giving to their residents the extra $300 a month in unemployment benefits that they could, right?
That's right. We've seen a number of states start to roll those federal benefits back.
And what's the strategy behind that? Why are they doing that?
Well, there's quite a bit of fear in the current labor market that we have a labor shortage, and it's partly the fear is it's partly engineered by these additional unemployment benefits, encouraging workers to continue to collect unemployment benefits with a federally extended program as opposed to returning to work. And you see a lot of help wanted signs up and down the street now.
Yeah. What's the solution to that? To the labor shortage?
The solution is, well, it's twofold. The question really is there actually a labor shortage? There's, from an economic perspective, some thought process that now that we've got folks returning to work, a lot of businesses are trying to hire at the same time. So there's a big demand for labor, and you likely see some sort of upward wage pressure that will result from this. That goes hand in hand with the inflation we've seen, too. As inflation comes up, workers generally demand higher wages to compensate for the increase in prices that they pay for other goods. So some level of wage increase or wage inflation is probably the likely solution here to what it appears to some to be a labor shortage. What I would really term is the labor market trying to find its equilibrium, its balance of supply and demand.
I saw a quote from the governor of, I think it was Montana, and he said, it's time for Montanans to get back to work. This seems to be the stick rather than the carrot, though, withholding money that the federal government has said your residents can have. I guess these are political decisions these people are making, and evidently the people of Montana and all of these red states agree with it. Is that your read on it?
I think there's some, maybe some truth on the margins that the extra unemployment benefits create a disincentive for some folks to seek employment as readily as they may otherwise. But I also think that the other side of the coin, that there is a balance to supply and demand, and there are a lot of people that are returning to work now that may not be accepting of the terms of employment before the pandemic, whether that's job flexibility or a rate of pay or otherwise.
So is it... Are the wages going up? Are, in fact, those people who aren't going back to work for whatever reason getting higher pay when they do go back?
We've not really seen average hourly earnings increase significantly in the last 5 or 6 months. It's trailing inflation, actually. So over the last 6 months, average hourly earnings are up about 1.9%. Consumer price inflation in that same period is up about 2.3%. So wages are trailing inflation for the first time really in almost a decade here in terms of wage growth. And those hourly earnings are not just people coming back to work. We can take 1% of that out as growth in the labor force. So there is some increase in wages, some small increase in wages, but it's not keeping pace with inflation right now.
So at least we are seeing the economy get better, and here's evidence of it. When states tell their residents you're not even going to get the money the federal government has allocated, the Fed is signaling an eventual shift too, right, in their money policies. Is that part of the evolution of coming out of the pandemic?
It certainly is. The Fed's been pretty persistent with their bond buying program each month. I think in the minutes of the most recent Fed meeting, it's pretty apparent there are a few of the Fed members that are starting to talk about, we need a plan for tapering this bond buying program. Obviously, there's no plans to do so yet. There's not kind of broad acceptance of that in the minutes by the Fed governors, but that's coming sooner rather than later. The better the economy does, the less we need monetary policy intervention like the Fed offers.
Any last thing on the horizon, any big picture economic trends that you see coming that we should be watching, Jason?
I think tying those recent economic trends to what we've seen in markets is one bit of intelligence. The amount of volatility we've seen this week and we've seen recently in the stock market is something we should expect to see over the next couple of months. We're going to see some choppy economic results here. There will be some good ones and some maybe not so good ones in the next couple of months on a year-over-year comparable and a month-to-month comparable. Riding out that short-term volatility is probably the best advice I can offer, and keeping an eye on the long-term that still looks pretty robust as we move out into 2021 and 2022.
Yeah, we're all used to the zigzag line, but you just answered the question I was going to ask. Do you see it zigzagging upward generally or downward? I think you just said upward, right?
Yeah, I think for the summer months, we're probably going to see some sideways zigzagging. There may be a correction or two kind of built into the market there over the summer months. But over the longer term, we're definitely remaining on an upward trend. And think of this as the transition from the initial recovery to more of a mid-cycle ongoing growth theme for the economy and markets.
I think that's a really interesting point. Jason Turner, head of multi-asset strategies at Wintrust Wealth Management. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Ian Schur, Editor-at-Large at CNET. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to the show.
How you doing?
Good. I'm a little surprised to see this headline on your website. It says that Twitter has a new service that'll cost $3 a month. I'll give you $3 if you take Twitter off my phone. What do I want to give Twitter $3 a month
for? Oh, my gosh. I'm right with you.
What's the new service?
It's interesting. The idea behind it is that Twitter has kind of hit its limit, right? There are a certain number of people who are going to use it, and a lot of those people are like us, right? They're in the news industry, or they're in sports, or maybe finance, a little bit of entertainment, and then that's about it. And other than when President Trump was using it, there wasn't a terrible amount of interest in Twitter beyond that core group of people. And so Twitter has been trying to figure out, okay, well, how do we make more money, right? Because at the end of the day, they're not a charity. They do need to make money. And this is one of the ways that they're trying. It's a $3 a month service they call Twitter Blue. And that is all we know so far. There are rumors beyond that. They say they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do with it. The rumors are that they're going to have an easy way for you to kind of collect together your favorite tweets, which admittedly is something I struggle with. I often have to go to Google to find a tweet, which is already kind of ridiculous. And they are going to probably, the most interesting part, charge $3 a month also for that undo button we've all been asking for. So suddenly we're getting into a precedent of Silicon Valley literally charging you for a button.
Wow. That's interesting because it's their app. They can do whatever they want. But I always thought the lack of an undo was a mistake. They're going to charge me $3 to fix their error. Maybe people will pay for it, but I'm not convinced, Ian.
I'm not either. I will say that undo is my favorite feature in Gmail. I actually have gone through the trouble of figuring out how to put it on Outlook and other stuff because it's so useful, right? The idea that I send something and then I've got like a minute to decide whether or not, oh, I forgot to add the word or I spelled someone's name wrong or whatever, and I get to pull it back. I almost pull back every email I write within that minute and end up adding to it or something before it actually sends out. So I totally get why Twitter is doing this. The question I have is also, why choose an undo button instead of an edit button?
Edit.
Which is
edit.
The thing we've all been asking for, right? I mean, Facebook has an edit button. Last time I checked, most of the internet is editable. I don't know why Twitter isn't. But, you know, that's part of what makes Twitter Twitter, is that it's hard to understand exactly what they're thinking all the time.
I think the edit button costs $4. Let's see. Parler is back. Parler is back at the Apple Store, huh?
Yeah, this is also an interesting thing. This came from, you know, Parler was this alternative social network that a lot of people kind of joined as a protest vote against Facebook and Twitter, particularly after the election. A lot of people were angry at having their accounts shut off for spreading election lies and whatnot. So Parler was getting really popular. And then the January 6th attack on the Capitol happened. A lot of people posted video from inside the Capitol or of them attacking police on Parler. And Apple said, no more, cut them off, killed the app. And so now they've been working with them to kind of bring it back. Apple said that one of the biggest problems they had was that they saw a lot of glorifying of Nazism in there, actual calls for violence against specific people, a lot of violence against ethnic groups, all of that happening in that app. And they said it's unacceptable. You need to somehow moderate this stuff. And that is what Parler apparently is finally starting to do.
Is this similar to the conversation we had about Donald Trump being delisted? That is, it's not the politics, it's the violence or some of the incendiary language. So in other words, Apple's not saying we're Republican or Democrat. We're just saying if you clean up your act, we'll put that on regardless of your views, as long as they're sensibly addressed.
I think that the struggle here is that a lot of the politics in this country have suddenly gone to the extremes. And so as a result, you have particularly one kind of high-profile part of the country really being extreme in their political speech and encouraging further. And a lot of that stuff is against the terms of service of a lot of these companies, right? And so as a result, they are getting kicked off and they're really frustrated. And you're right, it is the terms of service these people are violating. You can't threaten people on Facebook, Twitter, or Parler, apparently. And that is something that a lot of these people are very comfortable doing. And it's causing a lot of trouble.
Talk to me about this AT&T deal. What's the news here?
Yeah, this is one of the things that we've been watching for a lot of while on CNET. Part of the conversation we've been having around streaming services is that there are too many of them, right? There's like 20 of them I could name off the top of my head, right? HBO, Disney, Crackle, Hulu, I mean, I could go on. And so one of the questions has been, when are these things going to start consolidating and making it easier for us to subscribe to a bunch of them? Because I don't know about you, but I'm not willing to go through death by a thousand paper cuts and have a million subscriptions to watch whatever I want. So now we're starting to see that AT&T has said, you know what, we realize that we are not in the content business. We just want to sell you pipes, right? They want to sell us an internet connection. So they're cutting, they're getting rid of HBO and Warner, which is the company that owns HBO. They're combining it with Discovery Plus, which has a lot of that kind of reality show content, which pairs pretty nicely with like Game of Thrones and all this high-end television. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, but there's an expectation across the industry you're going to see a lot more consolidation, because I am not paying for 20 subscription services. I'll tell you that right now.
Are you saying HBO is now going to be more, or HBO is going to be morphed into, what will I look for HBO content? What do I search?
That's a great question. I mean, there's a lot of question marks now that we have. Right now, HBO is still HBO Max, right? There's still the people who you can use through that. And, of course, if you still have cable, you can subscribe. But I think one of the things they're trying to figure out, especially because Disney has been so successful with Disney Plus, right? It did way better than they expected. It jumped to what they thought it was going to be the size in 5 years. They did in 18 months. 100 million people subscribed. And so the question now is, you know, who is going to get all of this land grabbed up before everyone's sick and tired of paying? And that is the huge question that I think that AT&T is trying to answer.
Ian, sure, let's talk next week. Maybe we'll have more answers. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Take care.
Editor-at-large at CNET.com. There's a bike shop near me. I go by it all of the time. One day last summer, I went by it because they had all of these beautiful bikes on display in the window, and you could see that they had bicycles. When you went into the store, you realized that all the bicycles they had were the display, and there wasn't a floor full of bicycles. There was plenty of room for bikes, but there virtually were none. Some, but such a fraction of the total inventory they would carry. And we've since learned that that's just the way it was in the pandemic. When you do talk to people who know about bicycles in town, they will often say that one of the best shops in the Chicagoland area is the Pony Shop. It's in Evanston. Lou Kuhn is the owner of the Pony Shop. PonyShop.com is their website. And Lou, thanks for joining us today on WGN.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Do you go through the same sort of thing I noticed in my neighborhood, a lack of inventory?
We certainly have. It's been difficult almost right from the beginning of the pandemic all the way through this year. And we're still experiencing difficulties now getting product in a timely manner.
What kind of bikes do you sell?
We sell, brand-wise, we sell Cannondale and Giant. We do family bikes as well as higher-end racing bikes, mountain bikes, pretty much all the way across the board.
So what's the price range? A few hundred to a few thousand, something like that?
You know, 400 to 500 is kind of our starting point, and we go through 10 to 12,000.
Really? Some people spend that on a bicycle.
Some people do. That's usually somebody who's kind of planning out a long-term purchase. Not too many people walk in off and just walking off the street and just pick one of those up for themselves as an afternoon purchase. But, you know, they do plan ahead, and that's a purchase someone's going to ride for quite a few years.
Yeah. And the thing weighs about as much as a stapler, right?
They can get quite light, yeah, with the new modern materials, absolutely.
What's the popular style these days? Is it the still racing style? Is it the city with the short handlebars or with the big cow steer handlebars, you know?
I would say we do most with like a flat bar hybrid, which is something, you know, smaller tires. It's designed for the type of riding we have in Chicago, which is a lot of great bike paths, as well as, you know, obviously plenty of street riding, some crushed gravel trails. It's just the most efficient bike for the type of riding we do most around here.
I would imagine, though, the manufacturers and the stores would have caught up by now with the demand, no?
We really, honestly, if I would have predicted, I would have thought we would have been back to normal by now. But just a global shortage and then kind of a slowdown across the board with manufacturing as well as shipping and things like that, as well as container shortages, you know, delays at the ports. These things have all kind of added up. And unfortunately, we're still kind of getting back to normal. And I think it's going to be probably into next year before we feel like we're in a normal situation with traffic flow.
Does that put an emphasis then on repair? I'll bet your shop is busy that way.
It certainly has. That is an area where we've done much better this year. Last year, we were caught a bit off guard. Over the winter, we did a lot of ordering for more basic parts that we don't normally have to stock 10s and 20s of, you know, for instance. So we really did bolster that type of inventory, and we've been much better with being able to repair people's bikes quickly because of that.
Bicycles are like automobiles. You go in the showroom and you fall in love with them all. I mean, really, they are works of art in a way, aren't they?
Oh, I absolutely completely agree. I'm constantly myself wanting a new bike. At this point, though, I can't get one.
Do people order them? Do I put one on hold or reserve a bike?
We are doing reservations for bikes, so we can kind of pre-sell a bike and hold it for you based on a date that we're expected to get it. And you know, that's something we're totally comfortable doing as long as the customer is willing to wait and understands. And most are totally happy with that. Others, you know, I have good friends in the bike industry at other shops. You know, we call around. I've sent people all over the city. You know, honestly, a lot of people that want to get on a bike, it's instant gratification. They want to get out and enjoy the weather when it gets nice. If I can't help them, I just want to make sure they get into it and enjoy cycling.
Is it like the car and truck market? The inventory is good for used as well?
I think the used market is actually, it's very strong for sellers right now. We don't deal with used bikes here personally, but I am seeing used bikes sell for prices that are much higher than I would normally expect them to go for, and it's directly because you can't get a new bike.
Sell me a bike here. What's a bike you love that's practical and pretty and functional? What's a good bike to have right now?
Some of my favorites would be like the Cannondale Quick 3, which is, again, one of those flat bar road bikes, great for our kind of city riding and around town. We do a lot of Cannondale Synapses, which is a carbon road bike that's a little bit more comfortable position, say, than a bike you would see raced in the Tour de France, but still very quick and great for around here.
Suppose most of us want that hybrid tire too, right? Not too fat, but the thin ones, you hit a pebble of sand and you're out from underneath you, right?
They are a little bit more more prone to that, but we, even as racing bikes, the industry has started to go wider and wider now. We're riding almost a 28C tire is probably the average size tire for most people riding on road bikes now, which helps a lot with comfort as well as safety and control.
Is there a feature you like that's new to the business of bikes these days? What are people jazzing them up with?
Features that are new. I mean, my favorite features really, I'd probably say, are having disc brakes on most bikes. I think that's great for safety and control and just all-weather braking. As far as, you know, electronic shifting is another. That hasn't really trickled down yet. It's mostly, you know, on bikes, say, 4,000 to 5,000 and up. But I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot more of that. It's important for, you know, people with smaller hands or less, you know, strength in their hands, mm-hmm. both from the disc brake and the electronic standpoint helps very much. It's much easier to control the functions.
Disc brake, you mean pedal backwards, just bring it back a half a notch?
No, those are coaster brakes. Disc brakes actually like disc rotors on a car, so you really have a lot more stopping power.
But it's still a hand caliper then. You're pulling on the handle, right?
You're pulling on the handle, but you have a hydraulic disc brake, so it uses either mineral oil or DOT fluid.
Really?
It actually pushes pistons. Yeah, exactly.
So it's easier to operate.
Much easier.
And you make it sound like in wet weather, it's actually a safer bike that way?
It is certainly safer, yeah. It doesn't rely on the rim itself being clean or dry in order to create friction like a rubber brake pad would.
Was revenue up last year for you?
It was, yes.
How about that? And I presume this year will be better than last?
I think this year will be quite similar to last year, honestly. I think now that the pandemic is, some things are starting to calm down and reopen more. People are anxious to do other things. So I feel like we're going to see probably a very strong first half of the year. And then as we get into more kind of the vacation season, I think a lot of people are going to start doing some traveling that they've been missing out on.
One last thing. The city loves the Divvy bikes, and they also are renewing and buying more scooters. Is that a competition for you? Do you mind or do you embrace that?
I embrace it. I think the Divvy bike's a great program. We don't actually have scooters up here in Evanston. The jury's still out. In the city, I see them kind of leaned up and laying all over the place. For the Divvy bikes, at least a little bit more organized situation where you know where to find them. You know where to return them. It's not as random.
Yeah. What street are you on when I come up to Evanston, Lou?
We're on Chicago Avenue, 1224 Chicago Avenue in Evanston.
It's called The Pony Shop. You can look at it right now, ponyshop.com. Lou Kuhn, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's just another one of those instances. One of these days we're going to make a list, Pete, and it's going to be all of the businesses that suffered greatly for the pandemic and those that benefited greatly for the pandemic. And when this whole thing started, I don't know that we would have scored it perfectly well. It's 12:45 on WGN. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. McDonald's is promising to more than double its U.S. advertising spending with diverse-owned media and production companies and content creators. The focus will be on platforms owned by Black, Hispanic, Asian American, LGBTQ people, and women. Spending will go from 4% to 10% over the next 4 years. Spending with Black-owned media and production properties will increase from 2% to 5%. McDonald's will also be forming multi-year partnerships with diverse-owned media entities. Cranes also reports the company will form an advisory board to help identify and eliminate financial hurdles faced by diverse partners. UPS says it's looking to fill roughly 1,000 full and part-time positions across the Chicago area. The company is seeking tractor-trailer drivers and part-time workers who can make up to $24 an hour with annual raises. UPS will be hosting two hiring events at 1 UPS Way in Hodgkins on Saturday, May 22nd, and Thursday, May 27th, starting at 8 a.m. Applications can be found at upsjobs.com. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's time for the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir, and helping me with today's feature is James Earl Jones.
Ray, people will come, Ray.
That's from the movie Field of Dreams, of course, and there are two reasons I'm bringing that up today. One is a 1977 John Deere tractor, the 2640 model, well-maintained, a little rust here and there, good tires. Normally, that tractor would bring about $15,000, but the John Deere I'm talking about is the one that Kevin Costner drove in the Field of Dreams. When Costner, playing farmer Ray Kinsella, was plowing under his corn to make room for the baseball field, his young daughter, Karen, on his lap, he was at the wheel of a tractor borrowed from the Lansing family of Dyersville, Iowa, where the movie was filmed. At a recent auction, that tractor brought $64,000, and it wasn't even autographed by Costner. Meanwhile, the White Sox and Yankees are scheduled to play at a newly constructed ballpark right next to the Field of Dreams movie site in Dyersville. The National Corn Growers Association just signed on as a sponsor of the game and all the events surrounding it. John Linder is the president of the Corn Growers. Did I catch you on your tractor, John?
You did. I'm planting corn.
John farms in northern Ohio. He says the chance for the corn growers to sponsor a major league game on a field surrounded by corn, was just too cool to pass up.
What a great movie, right? And so the opportunity to have Major League Baseball play a game in a cornfield in Dyersville, Iowa. Wow. Who could say that would have happened? Boy, we're sure glad to be partnering in this and bringing all the Korn family with us.
Wow, indeed. Thursday, August 12th, the White Sox and the Yankees and whatever other players decide to walk out of the Korn, I guess. At the Chicago Board of Trade, Korn has been higher today over a dime at one point. Right now it's 7 cents higher at 6.65 and a quarter. Soybeans are down about 3 at 15.35. Wheat is trading down about a penny at 6.78. Today's Farm to Your Belly feature, it's National Quiche Lorraine Day. Cheese, eggs, milk, onions, bacon, cream. No farmers, no quiche Lorraine, or even quiche John. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us at this time. You know, I want to talk about travel, and I hope it's just not me. I know you've got a story about that, but I'm anxious to start traveling internationally, even nationally. Amy, you've got a story about that, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's one that a lot of people have been watching to find out about. So Europe is officially welcoming vaccinated tourists this summer, but there are a lot of caveats to that. So you have to have had one of the approved vaccines. You have to be fully vaccinated at least 14 days prior to entry. The wording of it is a little confusing. I saw a couple of people on social media starting to take this another way, because the wording is kind of around, it kind of goes like foreign travelers have to have received one of the coronavirus vaccines. But that doesn't mean one vaccine, that means fully vaccine. Right. But what they're referring to is the variety, the different brands of vaccines. But the other caveat is that ultimately each member state of the European Union will decide the particulars of foreign travelers entering their borders. So it won't be across the board. Here's what Europe is doing. They're saying, we agree, we're going to let some tourists in, but then each country is going to decide individually. So if you're going to travel internationally, double check what is required for American travelers to enter, because that still might require, if you're not vaccinated, you know, maybe a COVID test. That might, even if you are vaccinated, that might require a couple of days in a hotel. If you're traveling with children, there are other considerations there if they're too young to be vaccinated. So double check. But the headline here is that European countries are going to start letting foreign travelers in.
I guess that's a good point to emphasize. I mean, a lot of people go to Europe on a cruise. I'm doing the river cruise. Some of the folks will bicycle or just get a car and travel through Europe. So the point is, you're in more than one country. So France may say yes and Belgium may say no or whatever, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Even, you know, yeah, exactly. Countries right there next to each other might have totally different policies. So if you're planning on, okay, I'm going to fly to France and take a train down to Spain and then come back to France and fly out, you need to check what's going on for both France and Spain, because they will have possibly very different different things where you might have to, you know, quarantine for a couple of days or something like that.
Oatly is doing well. What's Oatly and what's the story here?
Yeah, so Oatly is, and I can already hear Orion Samuelson's voice in my head as I mm-hmm. say this, but it is an oat-based milk. It was introduced about a year and a half ago, really got popular about a year and a half ago. It was introduced a couple years ago, but it made its market debut earlier this morning, and its shares were up 24%. Overnight, the offering was $17 a share. Opening trade was $22.12. That was holding until just about noon Eastern time. I think it's very interesting. Oatly is an interesting case because a lot of Wall Street watchers for the plant-based foods category have been keeping an eye on this and comparing it to like Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat and that kind of category. Well, the company is now, you know, its valuation is now $13.1 billion, which is larger than, you know, than Beyond Meat. So we also have a lot of celebrities that have backed this. Certainly the former CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, he was behind Oatly quite early. So I think a lot of that push from Starbucks probably helped its popularity. Actor Natalie Portman has invested in it. Oprah has invested in it. A couple of other, you know, venture capital funds and some regular backers of companies, Blackstone, things like that. They invested about $200 million in the company last year. They have about a 10% stake. So it's interesting to just see, you know, this really rapid expansion of plant-based food. And Oatly has expanded into like ice cream and yogurt and that kind of stuff. It's all oat-based. Again, I can just hear Orion like cringing. Interesting to see how they've grown and how they're performing today.
Time for just the headline here, Amy, but the Peloton fix is in, right? The good kind of fix.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A while back, you and I had talked about this treadmill that was possibly going to be recalled because of a safety issue. The belt was pulling in pets and small children underneath it, and they were getting trapped, and there were some injuries. There was even one death of a six-year-old child. So there ultimately was a recall of about 125,000 of the Tread and Tread Plus products. There's now a software update that will put kind of a lock on the treadmill if it's not in use for a certain amount of time, if it's out of a class period, things mm-hmm. like that, so that a child couldn't come up and, you know, tap buttons and get the belt moving.
That's good news from Amy Booth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.